Session is HTTPS in 2015, so hopefully that's what you're all here for. My name is Eric Lawrence. I currently work for Telerik. I build Fiddler, which is a web debugger for them. But prior to that, I worked on the Internet Explorer team at Microsoft, and I was a security program manager there for about 10 years. And so that's kind of how I got into the whole HTTPS thing and why I'm here today. One of the advantages of doing in-person conferences is that I don't have to be like a YouTube video where I just kind of, give my talk. So I'm interested in learning a little bit more about the audience. So how many people here have ever used SSL, deployed SSL on a product or service that they build? Very good number. That's awesome. Okay. How many people are building websites and client applications, mobile applications? Okay, awesome. So it's a great audience for this talk because you guys are exactly the sorts of people that I'm hoping to reach. Let's move on. So, one question is, why do this talk now? And I think that, the reason that I picked HTTPS in 2015 is because I think 2015 is going to be a bit of a pivotal year in terms of SSL and HTTPS. And so there's a lot of interesting things that are happening or in the process of happening. And the other part of that, of course, is that the last 2 or 3 years have been very interesting years in SSL as well, but mostly in a negative way. And so there's been a lot more awareness of prevalent, attacks against crypto and attacks against privacy of users, as well as bugs and other shortcomings in the deployed SSL implementations. And so that awareness is helping to drive improvement, but it's also, driving a fair bit of alarm from people who are outside the industry and look at it and say, wow, these guys just have no idea what they're doing. And the answer, of course, is it's much more complicated than that. But why use SSL at all? And so the first reason is just bad guys, right? So, you bring your laptop to the coffee shop and you try to go to your bank and, if there's a bad guy there on the network, he can do bad things to your information, steal your identity, change transactions and things like that. And, that's sort of the canonical threat model for encryption is, to prevent bad guys from doing bad things to sites that you care about. Government snooping is a huge one now, right? So with the awareness that we've received over the last few years about how many different governments are working to collect information about what users are doing and where they're doing it and the information that flows across the network. And so, in the past, it was always sort of understood that governments and other entities would try to, target particular individuals to understand what they're doing. But the awareness we've received is actually that there are governments that are sort of, sitting on the fiber backbones and looking to see what everybody is doing all the time in hopes of getting some information that's of use to them. And there's lots of people that have problems with that. Now, there's a set of people, of course, who say, I'm a good guy, I've got nothing to hide, I don't care if the government is spying on me. And for that audience, the points that I want to make is, we're not limited to the threat model against, the government and bad guys. There's also people who are trying to add value. And so some of those people trying to add value are sort of like network service providers. So a great example recently is there's a company called Gogo. They provide in-flight wireless on airplanes. And one of the things that Gogo does is they want to make sure that you're not using too much of their bandwidth. And so if you go to a site like YouTube, they will actually intercept your communications with YouTube and basically make it so the streaming videos either don't work or are throttled and things like that. And so in order to do that, they actually mount an attack on your SSL connections. And they've probably been doing this for quite some time, but about a week ago, a Chrome security engineer was on a plane and this happened. And so she tweeted a screenshot and went all over the world with like, oh my God, this horrible, horrible thing. And so, these non-neutral networks are potentially spying on your traffic or potentially altering your traffic. And so that's of concern to a certain set of people. And then the last set, I would say, is people who feel that they're adding value to the traffic. And so their definition of value and your definition of value are quite likely not the same thing. In some cases, it might be they're trying to block malware or phishing or things like that. So your organization may have an intercepting gateway or firewall that's going to change the traffic. And, you may agree with that and you might be happy with that. But it might also be like your cell phone network you know, trying to say, well, you know, we would really prefer if they see our ads rather than these other ads. And so there's an ISP or a startup, I think, in Israel that's building basically equipment that you put in your mobile ISP and it rewrites the traffic with their advertising. And that's not a value that I'm particularly excited to receive. And so there are rewards from deploying SSL beyond just sort of helping to defeat these scenarios that you don't care about. One is increased user trust, and this is sort of the historical one that people pointed out. So if you're like, you know, doing an online shop, people are more likely to buy stuff if you're using SSL. It provides some amount of increased sort of believability and the credibility of your site. You're not just some random guy. You've got a certificate, and it's great. And that's always been there, but more and more people are sort of looking for that over time. Google felt that this wasn't really enough, and so recently they've announced that they're going to provide sort of additional search relevance ranking for things that sites that are on SSL, and so you're more likely to get an earlier search result in Google if your site is using SSL, and so that's one of the ways that they're sort of trying to nudge the web. And that's a recurring theme that you'll see in this talk, is that Google is really pushing HTTPS a lot more than you might expect, and they're doing so in a very broad set of ways. And then the last thing is more reliable egress. And so the scenario here is if you're using something like the Speedy protocol or the HTTP2, the forthcoming HTTP2 protocol to accelerate your website, or you're using advanced technologies like WebSocket, one of the problems is that a lot of the historic intermediaries, so the proxies and the gateways and the scanners and so forth, they expect HTTP traffic when you're seeing connections from client machines to the internet. And if they don't see HTTP traffic, they might break. So they might say, oh, look, you know, there's this connection from, you know, the browser to this server, and, you know, there's a bunch of WebSocket-related stuff, but it's just HTTP, right? And then they mangle your traffic. And so they've done research and shown that, you know, if you actually want to use WebSockets reliably against a site, you almost have to use HTTPS because there are a small number of intermediaries that affect, you know, a non-trivial percentage of traffic that can cause your traffic not to work. And so when you're trying to accelerate your site or service using one of these new protocols, using HTTPS is a way to effectively help ensure that the users are getting the content that they expect. So that's the why. The where, the stack, you've got your client browser, your client application, your mobile phone. You've got HTTP, the protocol that you're primarily using. You've got SSL and TLS, SSL Secure Socket Layer, TLS Transport Layer Security. It was renamed part of a standards agreement. But basically, they're fundamentally evolutions of the same thing, and people tend to use them interchangeably. Some people who are really pedantic go TLS all the time, and then normal humans are like, is that like SSL? And, you know, but it's not really worth discussing the distinctions there. And then below them, you typically have TCP and IP, where, you know, these untrusted communication protocols. So what does HTTPS really provide? There's three core things that it tries to provide. It provides authentication, and typically that's server authentication, so you're authenticating that you're really talking to the server you expect. If you're in Europe, it's more common to see also client authentication, where you provide a smart card or certificate identifying that your browser is really your browser, and so when you're talking to your bank or your government tax revenue collection and things like that, you're identifying yourself in a very secure way. Provides confidentiality, and it's a limited confidentiality because, and we'll talk about some of the shortcomings later, but basically the notion is that while someone may be able to, on the wire, may be able to see that you're talking to a given server, they can't see what you're saying or what the server is saying back. And then it provides integrity to help ensure that when you're talking to the server and the server is replying back to you, that those messages are not being generated by some bad guy in the middle, and that the messages that you send are what the server is really receiving, and what you receive from the server is really what the server tried to send to you. And so these are three really important things if you want to do a lot of things on the internet. And historically it was, well, it's banking, right? Banking is where this matters, and everything else, it's like, it doesn't really need to be secure. But because of the problems that we've seen where people have started to take advantage of the unsecure nature of a lot of the web traffic, it now is actually fairly important to ensure that we're using HTTPS on a lot of things. And I'll try and make that case throughout the deck. So how are these three guarantees provided? First is we use public key infrastructure for certificate change. So we'll talk about that. We use public key crypto for the key exchanges so that we can exchange secret keys to talk to one another. And then we'll use symmetric cryptography for transferring data between the client and the server. And there's variants of all of these things, but these are the three core mechanisms. So first, we have our certificate, right? A certificate is not a magical structure. It's just a file. It's formatted. using an abstract syntax notation, which is not a wonderful protocol like JSON that we all love to look at, but it's this binary goo thing that was designed by a standards committee, and it's actually quite complicated and is the source of a huge number of bugs over the years. But generally speaking, you can think of it as a file that contains a certain number of key value pairs, and those key value pairs provide information about the entity that owns the certificate. And the important bit is that it's signed. And so the signature is how you know that this certificate is actually legitimately created. So one of the ways that the certificate is validated is via hash. So effectively, hash algorithms are a very important part of SSL. They're used in a variety of places. Hash algorithms, as you know, if you're a computer science background or in this field for any length of time, is you take a body of data and reduce it to a smaller body of data. And so in most cases, it's 160 bits value. There's different algorithms, and this is something that's going to come up throughout the talk. There's different algorithms for all of these things. MD5 was a very popular algorithm in the 90s. It's now completely broken. One of the worst things that we see around SSL is there's a lot of things that are either dependent on old algorithms and fail with new algorithms, and it makes it very hard to retire things. And so one of the key aspects of the way that HTTPS is implemented is to attempt to have crypto agility and hash agility. And unfortunately, deployments make that very hard. But with the backing of some major players, we're doing some good work to get rid of those. So MD5 is bad. SHA-1, by far the dominant hash algorithm that's in use today. It's used by almost everybody. Even Google, who's leading sort of the charge of getting off SHA-1, is currently using SHA-1 on most of their certificates. And there's some reasons for that. Things like Windows XP SP2 did not support stronger versions of SHA. And so, they've got some non-trivial number of users in China that are still using unpatched versions of Windows XP SP2. And so they're using SHA there. But they plan on moving off SHA-1 in the relatively near future. And they've taken some very aggressive moves there. So they actually, on Windows, when they detect that Chrome is running on Windows XP, they actually funk the network stack and replace their SHA-1 only implementation that Windows provides with one that also supports SHA-256, which is kind of funny. Microsoft, of course, would prefer that people just get off this ancient thing. And there's some other reasons why that's important. But the expectation is that SHA-256 is going to start to enter the mainstream this year. And there's been things that are underway to sort of help promote that. Like if you use a SHA-1 keyed certificate with an expiration date after 2015, Chrome is going to start lighting up UI saying, this is kind of dangerous. And so a lot of sites really, after paying good money for an SSL certificate, don't want Chrome complaining about the site in any way. And so we expect that SHA-256 will start to enter the mainstream. So we'll get to the actual handshake in a minute, but how does a certificate work at all, right? It's not just a certificate. A site presents you a certificate for itself. And when the browser receives that certificate, it has to ensure that that certificate is legitimate and properly being sent by that site. So the first thing it has to do is to make sure that the certificate itself is intact, that the hash that's provided in the certificate is matching the hash of the data. Because otherwise you could just take any given certificate that you were issued and then go change the information in it. And so you have to make sure the certificate itself has been signed properly. You have to ensure that the certificate is within its validity period. And so when you buy a certificate, it has a lifetime. And, back in the day, sometimes you'd get like 5 or 10 year certificates. And that's horrible because your 5 or 10 year certificate was usually signed with something like MD2 or MD4 or even MD5. These hash algorithms that really didn't last that long. And so you typically see much shorter lifetime certificates these days. A lot of people think the validity period is not especially important. And so in Internet Explorer 7, when we started to ramp up the certificate warning UI, people said, well, hey, if the certificate's valid or not, it's valid, but it's not within its validity period, it expired. Why not just let it go, but maybe tell the user it's okay, but maybe not great. And the answer is that there's actually a lot of hidden subtlety in the way that the validity period works. And so, one of the things that we like to compare it to is, if you have a credit card, the credit card has an expiration date on it, right? And the credit cards have had expiration dates on them from the very beginning. And the reason that credit cards had expiration dates on the very beginning, back in, the 80s, is that when a credit card is stolen, the credit card company says, oh, okay, well, this number is no longer valid anymore. and they would, you know, have this information. But what did they do with it? Well, they would actually collect this information, because remember, this is back before, you know, when you'd like, you'd run the little roller over and take a copy and an imprint or whatever. And so they had this information of like, well, this card is not valid. But they had to distribute that information to everybody that could accept the credit card. So they printed the invalid credit cards in a book. Well, if you didn't have an expiration, that book would grow to an infinite length. And so they had to say, well, okay, our cards are only good for 2 years. And then after the card is no longer valid, we stop printing the number in the book because no one will accept it because it's not valid. People did not believe that this is the way certificate authorities worked. They said, hey, this is not, they're not printing in books. Who cares? The list can be infinitely long. And the answer is actually certificate authorities do expunge revoked certificates after the validity period. Not all of them, but enough of them that it's a real problem. And so the validity period is actually pretty relevant. You gotta make sure that it chains to a trusted root. So you can make your own certificate. You can go sit down on your machine, OpenSSL, C#, you know, any number of ways, and you can create your own certificate. The trick about it is that in order for the browser to accept it without freaking out and alerting the user, is it has to chain back to a certificate authority. There's certificate authority, people like VeriSign, Thought, Komodo, etc., and that market is actually coalesced where there's actually a relatively small number of American certificate authorities, most of which are brands of VeriSign at this point. They sign the certificate and they say, hey, the person that we're signing the certificate for prove to our level of assurance that they are who they say they are. And so this certificate is actually identifying the party that it claims to. And so the browser actually has to make sure that that chain is valid. The chaining is incredibly complicated. In most cases, it's very simple. You have an end entity certificate on a server that chains to an intermediate certificate, that chains to a root certificate. That's the great version. But in reality, very often, there's multiple chains. And the reason is because sometimes some devices don't trust some roots. And so you have a certificate that's what's called cross-signed, where it's signed by multiple different roots. And the browser has to go follow those back. And you have to watch out for attacks like, well, what if a certificate chains to an intermediate certificate that ends up chaining back to that certificate? You can end up in a loop, you could crash the software, it could get accepted invalidly, and so forth. And so that's actually quite complicated. The key thing for browsers is that when the browser visits a site like Google.com, it has to ensure that the certificate it gets is actually for Google.com. Because I could just go get an EricLawrence.com certificate and then man in the middle of your connection to Google. And if the browser just accepted any old certificate that it got that chained back to a trusted root, that would be a problem. So within the certificate, you've got a field called the subject CN. So you see it up here, subject, and then you have some identity information, but if you got all the way over to the right, it would say like cn.google.com or whoever the certificate was for. You also have a subject alternate name. So the subject CN has a problem that it can only hold one site in it. And so, you know, google.com. But if you want to have mail.google.com, well, you either need another certificate or you need a certificate that has subject alt names. And the subject alt names can contain more than one string. And so that allows you to do things where you've got, you know, mail.google.com any of the other properties that you want within that certificate. So the browser has to ensure that the certificate has a host name within it that matches the target site. Wildcards are possible, so you can have star.google.com. Most CAs will actually charge you quite a bit of money for that. Most CAs will give you for free, so if you've got, you know, EricLawrence.com, they'll give you a cert that has both Eric Lawrence and www.ericlawrence.com for the same price, because users might use both. But if you want a wildcard, usually you're going to pay a lot more for that. And then lastly, the browser needs to see whether or not it's revoked, and we'll talk about the protocol for that in a minute. Now, around the 2004-2005 timeframe, we're starting to do the new SSL certificate UI in Internet Explorer. Two interesting things came afoot. One of them was that there was a phishing site that was phishing bankofthewest.com. And this phishing site was one of the earliest ones that was very unique in one particular way. They had an SSL certificate, so the browser showed a lock icon. How did they do this? Well, they had registered bankofthevvest.com, and that was their phishing URL, and they got a certificate for it because they actually legitimately could prove that they had that domain. And so they had a phishing site that had bankofthevvest.com and showed the lock, and people freaked out because everybody knows that phishing sites are not supposed to have lock icons. And so, you know, eventually their certificate got revoked, but that was a wake-up call that what had happened is there was over the course of the 90s and early 2000s, there was an erosion in the way that certificates worked. In the 90s, if you wanted a certificate, you went to VeriSign, you gave them $700, they would look up your business history, they would look up your identity information, they would check the criminal databases, etc., and ultimately they would issue you a certificate. Well, people sort of looked at the requirements for issuing certificates and were like, well, we don't actually have to do much of that at all. All we really need to do is make sure that that person is in control of whatever host name they're getting a certificate for. And in fact, they would allow people to register certificates that contain essentially entirely bogus data as long as the URL in the certificate matched the URL of the server. And they could do this really cheap because you don't need a human being. You can automate this entire process. And so you have certificate authorities that were issuing what are called domain validated certificates, where you validate the domain. These things were like $15 or $20. Well, when you go from $700 to $20, there's a big difference in what you're getting. And so we felt we needed to create a distinction between these high assurance certificates that were providing a great deal of validation and these domain validated certificates. And that's how the extended validation, or EVSSL, was born. And EVSSL was designed as a way to provide the user with additional cues when they were interacting with a site that had actually gone through a thorough identity vetting. And we would deploy, we would show on the user interface information about that certificate to the user so that they could make their decision. So, you know, bankofthewest.com would get a green bar, legitimately say Bank of the West up there and so forth. Whereas if these Bank of the VVEST guys wanted that same experience, they would have to provide business information showing that they had a business legitimately registered with that name and so forth. And so that was what extended validation came about. Now, of course, People are people, developers are developers, and they immediately said, oh, this is just a horrible scheme for Internet, Microsoft to, collude with VeriSign to justify crazy high prices for certificates and blah, blah, blah. There were no kickbacks. There was nothing of that sort. But people, of course, were pretty skeptical. And EVSSL has had a relatively slow rollout because the prices are somewhat higher. But I think you can get them for about $190 or so today. They'll come up again. Now, when you interact with a website and you're negotiating a secure channel, you end up coalescing around a set of algorithms that you're going to use to communicate with that. And that comes back to the earlier point that SSL is all about agility, because a browser that was built 10 years ago very often needs to interact with a site that was built yesterday. And protocols for security are frequently being broken and being replaced and being strengthened and so forth. And so browsers and servers, when they connect to one another over SSL, have to agree on a set of parameters that they're going to use for that communication. And we'll see how that works in a minute. But when you look at logs and things like that, you'll often see a string like this. And this is out of an excellent book, which we'll talk about. But effectively, you see the label saying how the keys are going to be exchanged. You see how the authentication is done to ensure that the site is presenting that the connection is relevant, is valid for the certificate that's being issued. There's an encryption algorithm for the encryption of the data, the bitness strength of that encryption, the mode that encryption is being used in, and this set is called the cipher very often. And then sometimes you'll have a trailer containing the method that's being used for message authentication code or the pseudo random function, which is used in newer algorithms. So when you make a connection, you connect to port 443 on the server, and the client sends a client hello. The client hello basically contains, hey, I'm looking to talk to google.com. I'm willing to support any of these following communication protocols. So I'll use RSA, and I'll use AES, and I'll support RC4, and so forth. The server then responds with, hey, here's the algorithm that I think that we should use. So the idea is that it's supposed to pick the strongest one that they both support. It provides a certificate. So it says, hey, and here's my certificate so that you can validate this certificate and get the parameters that we're going to use to exchange keys. And then ultimately, the client, after validating that the server certificate is valid, then switches over to use the secure communication mechanism. This handshake gets more and more complicated as you add more and more options. There are variants of this handshake. But this is the key thing, basically. The client says, hey, I want to talk to you. I'm willing to do the following. And the server says, hey, I'm this site, and let's use this cipher. And so that's the key thing of the initial handshake. If you ever use Fiddler, if you click on one of the connect panels in Fiddler, it shows you a breakdown. So it parses that handshake and shows you the information within it. And so you see very at the top which version of the protocol is being used. So TLS 1.2 is version 3.3, which is a little confusing until you remember that SSL 3 came along and then TLS came along. And so they said TLS 1.0 is SSL 3.1. You have some random data that the client exchanges. Technically, the first 4 bytes of that are supposed to be a date time string, but it turned out that that was a good way of figuring out what the client's clock was at, which is bad, so now browsers just send random values there. You have a session ID, which is used if you want to resume a previous session. We'll talk about that. And then you have TLS extensions. So when TLS extensions were first added, they tended to blow everything up. And this was a huge problem for Windows Vista. If you tried to load Alaska.com, which all the Microsoft executives flew on, using Windows Vista, the site would just totally fail. And the reason is because TLS extensions were added to the protocol in TLS, and SSL 3 didn't have them. It technically reserved the extension mechanism, but it didn't have any extensions. And so people who were running outdated server software, if you tried to send extensions, it would close the connection immediately, saying, oh my god, somebody's trying to hack me. And so extensions now are actually quite well supported. There's a whole bunch of them. The relevant ones for our conversation for now are server name, where the client indicates what server it's trying to talk to, revocation mechanisms, elliptic curve info. So some of the new algorithms use elliptic curves rather than RSA. We'll talk about that. ALPN, so that's application level protocol notification. So this is how you negotiate an HTTP2 connection. When you make the connection to the site securely, you say, by the way, if it's possible, I'd like to speak HTTP2. And so you would see that there if that was taking place. And next protocol negotiation is the prior version of that. And then you have a list of ciphers. And so this is, I think, a Windows 8.1 machine. And this is the list of things that the client is willing to talk to the server with. The SNI extension bears a brief mention. So the server name extension is used to handle the problem that previously, when the client connected, it would connect to the IP address and say, hey, I'm here, let's talk. And the server was expected to send back a certificate that said, this is who I am. Well, the problem is that ends up creating a one certificate per IP address limitation, because otherwise the server doesn't know which certificate to send back. And in the early days, this sort of seemed reasonable, because if you were so crazy that you had an SSL site, or the bank, right, you're not going to be sharing your server with anybody else. Well, very quickly this became a problem, because of course, for virtual hosting, you're on the same server as 50 other different companies. And so when you make that connection to port 443 on that IP address, it doesn't know which certificate to send. Well, the server name extension allows the server to see who you think you're talking to, and that allows it to give you back the proper certificate. Unfortunately, this extension was not supported in Windows XP. I literally begged on my knees for the team that was responsible for the SSL stack to put it in the service pack, but they declined to do so. It's also not supported on old version of Android, versions prior to 2.3. So basically, the entire world is sort of waiting with bated breath for those platforms to reach a level of deployment that is deemed irrelevant enough to ignore, because that's going to help unblock the virtual hosting of SSL. It's actually fairly safe today, like if you don't care about certain classes of users. And some sites are starting to depend on server name indicator, but most major sites have not. The server responds with a relatively compact server hello, where you can see they select which version of the protocol that they're willing to speak. So they're going to also use TLS 1.2. Information, a random number. A cipher. So basically, this has chosen a relatively old cipher. It's decided it's going to use RSA for key exchange. It's going to use RC4 for bulk data. And then the hashing algorithm is MD5. It's not going to use compression. And the server sent back an extension renegotiation info saying that it's aware of this TLS renegotiation attack that was that came out a few years back. But it's relatively simple. One of the problems with the most common uses of SSL is that the RSA public key crypto algorithm has a shortcoming. And that shortcoming is, if your private key ever becomes known, you can actually use traffic captures of secure communications and go decrypt all of them. Because you, once you get the private key, can go decrypt all of the handshakes and get all of the symmetric keys and then decrypt all of the traffic. Well, at one point, this seemed ridiculous. Who's going to record all the traffic on the internet? Who has the ability and who has the hard drives? Well, we now know the answer to that question. So non-forward secret algorithms like RSA are quickly being deprecated for the use of key exchange. So there's some advice here from this Bulletproof SSL and TLS book, which is when you're looking for your, which algorithms you want to prioritize these elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman key exchanges or Diffie-Hellman key exchange in those. And so RSA is still around. You use RSA to validate very often that the certificate is valid, but you're not using it for the key exchange. You're using it for validity. And RSA is being replaced in some other places too.
Yeah. Isn't it possible to still decrypt all the traffic even without the private key if you have a wide enough data sample?
That goes into a much larger question. The short answer is it shouldn't be possible to decrypt the traffic without the private key if you had a large enough data sample. But actually, it becomes somewhat true when you consider things like weaknesses in RC4, which we'll briefly discuss later. But yes, generally speaking, you don't want anybody to have your complete set of traffic because even though currently it's not believed to be possible to decrypt it, we're constantly finding like, oh wait, there actually is this bias in this algorithm that we thought was good enough. But the hope is that those will be rare enough that it's not as much of a problem. But yes, generally speaking, if you're ever a security person and you say the following combination of things is secure, I'm going to copy that into a folder that says no. And then like 3 years from now, I'm going to post a tweet of it saying, ha ha ha, nothing is ever secure. But generally speaking, forward secret is the best that we can do at the moment. Okay. Popular ciphers. So triple DES. DES was an encryption standard a long, long time ago. It was not secure enough, so they figured, okay, well, we'll use it three times, and that'll be three times as secure. It kind of worked. Triple DES is breakable and bad and shouldn't be used, but old clients still support it. RC4, which is another quite old cipher algorithm, which is was believed until relatively recently to be pretty decent, but now is being effectively falling under the brunt of the attacks against it, and so people are trying to migrate off of RC4. AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, was the replacement for DES, and it's basically a, you know, a recommendation. It's pretty strong, and in a particular mode, it's the one that most secure server operators should be using today. And there's a new one that's called ChaCha, which is being evangelized by the guys at Google. It was put in Android. The advantage of ChaCha is that it's more performant than AES, particularly on low-spec devices like your smartphone, which is using the ARM instruction set. And so this is a screenshot from their blog post where they announced, hey, here's why we want to use this thing. Effectively, you can do faster bulk encryption and decryption. And so ChaCha at this point, I believe, is only still supported by Chrome and Android stuff. I don't know whether or not it's made it into Firefox yet, and I keep asking the IE guys whether or not they'll support it, but I haven't heard back. So, I mentioned earlier that once you have a certificate, the browser needs to make sure that the CA hasn't revoked it. So if you had inadvertently issued a certificate, so that bank of the VVEST, it turns out they're only using it for malice, certificate authority wants to revoke it. There's two ways to revoke a certificate. One is via certificate revocation lists, which actually works like that old book of, you know, expired credit card numbers. You talk to the CA and you say, hey CA, please send me the list of every certificate you've expired. And they send you back this blob, which may be 50K, or it may be like, I think I saw one that was like 1.9 megabytes, which is horrible. And so the performance implications of that are pretty bad. And so as a consequence, what the certificate revocation list often does is it caches. So it'll cache for a week, or it'll cache for longer than that. And so, you know, it's okay. Eventually you'll find out that that the certificate has been expired. It's better than nothing, but it's not fast enough. There's another protocol called Online Certificate Status Protocol, where your browser directly immediately sends a request to the CA and says, hey, is this particular certificate expired? And the CA can then immediately respond yes or no. Yes?
When you say expired, you mean revoked.
Oh, sorry, revoked. And so when the certificate has been revoked, the CA can come back and say, hey, that certificate has been revoked. There's a couple of problems with OCSP. One, you're still making a connection to the server, so it's going to take some time. Two, it tells the CA that you're validating the certificate. So if I'm going to some website, I don't want some third party to know, hey, I'm visiting this website because maybe it's, you know, I don't know, nsaleaks.com or something. If that's a real website, I don't know. But anyway, so like I don't want to send that information. And then the other thing is, if there's a network attacker for both certificate revocation list or OCSP, the network attacker can just fail my connection to that site so that I actually can't talk to the CA. And by default, browsers will silently ignore certificate revocation checks that don't come back. There's a registry key that you can use to turn on to provide this sort of obscure little warning in Internet Explorer, but normal human beings don't know what this means. But generally speaking, OCSP and CRL are not useful for many of the types of things that are attacks of concern. There are some people who have gone so far as to say that it's like a seatbelt that snaps when your car wrecks, and that's not true. And it's really frustrating that they say that. It's more like a bike helmet that doesn't prevent you from drowning. Bike helmets are still useful. Drowning is something to worry about, but you wouldn't expect your bike helmet to protect you from drowning. And so, I have loved mixing my metaphors, but that is revocation. And revocation is useful, but it does not solve a major part of the problem. In response to that, one of the things browsers have started to do is, and OSs have started to do, is deploy those block lists of certificates to the client just directly. So out of band, Windows Update will send you, hey, this certificate stuff is no longer good. Chrome will send your browser, hey, these certificates are not good anymore. And so revocation is something that continues to get invested. A relatively newer approach is what's called certificate pinning, whereby the browser keeps track of which certificates are good for which sites. And so this is, when Google sends you Chrome, there's a list in Chrome that says, hey, if you're going to google.com, gmail.com, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the certificate chain had better go through the following certificates or it's not valid. And so this is actually how, over the past few years, we've discovered all of the, government spying in Tunisia and Iran and everything else, because users load up Gmail and they get this block page, and that block page sends off telemetry to Google that says, by the way, we got the following search chain when we were trying to go to google.com. And then Google guys investigate, and they're like, oh my God, this Dutch certificate authority was completely compromised. And so certificate pinning is an interesting approach. The way that it was done previously required a lot of collaboration between the sites and the browser vendors, and that just doesn't scale. And so there's this new thing, which is called public key pinning, whereby you can send an HTTP response header that says, hey, if the user ever connects to my site in the future, here's the certificate chain to require. Now, there's still a bootstrapping problem, because if they attack you on the very first visit, you're never going to get this header. But if I'm securely using PayPal at my house or whatever, and then I later bring out my laptop to the coffee shop, it's going to catch those attacks. There's also third-party approaches. So Microsoft has this tool called the Extended or Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. So Emmet 5.1 has certificate pinning. And they did that because Internet Explorer does not currently support certificate pinning, although it probably will in the future, I think. There's another approach to dealing with certificates called certificate transparency. And this is a relatively new approach. But the idea is that one of the shortcomings in the certificate infrastructure today is that any site or any certificate authority, and browsers tend to trust between 1 and 300 certificate authorities, can issue a certificate for any site on the Internet. And so some little, Dutch CA can issue a certificate for Microsoft.com. Or, the Indian government CA can issue a certificate for Google.com. And so this is deemed to be, bad, because now we have 300 potential points of failure. And so what certificate transparency does is it effectively requires that when you issue a certificate, the CA signs it and publishes the fact that they've issued that certificate into a global log. And what this means is that you can have log monitors. And the log monitors, so if I run Microsoft.com, I have a log monitor that just checks this record every single day to see if there's any references for certificates for my site. And if there are and I don't understand them, I can go investigate and find out, oh, the CA got compromised, and then get those revoked through the traditional means. Certificate transparency is relatively new. The big thing for 2015 is Google's going to start requiring this for all their extended validation SSL certificates. So if you get the green bar in Chrome, that means that that certificate had been successfully published to the certificate transparency log. Now, one of the biggest complaints about SSL is it performant enough? And the answer is, generally speaking, yes. It is obviously possible to mess up performance with TLS, but Google's head of performance basically says it's got one performance problem, which is it's not being used enough. There's some wonderful anecdotes from guys on major sites like Google and Facebook saying, hey, we use it, it's fast enough, you're worried about it pegging your CPU, things like that, that's not really a concern. There's a bit of a disclaimer on at least the claim from the guy from Google. He provides some numbers there. It's fair to say it's only fair to mention that he's talking about a custom version of OpenSSL that they built. But they're starting to share that code back to the community, and so you're going to start to see improvements in OpenSSL and other platforms to improve scalability. The slowest part of a TLS connection is the establishment, where you're agreeing on what secrets you're going to use to encrypt your data. And the improvement that is available is this thing called session resumption, where most browsers make multiple connections to servers, and they need to, you know, you don't want to go through this whole dance on every single connection. And so you've got this notion called session resumption, which is when I'm reconnecting either in parallel or at some reasonably defined later point in time to that server, I can resume a TLS session that I had with that server. And that's going to save me a lot of the asymmetric encryption time and round trips. And so session resumption is accomplished in two ways, via the session ticket or via the session ID, which is the older way. Session ticket allows you to have a server farm rather than just relying on affinity with one server and one client. The session ID is the prior way. Another performance improvement that's coming about is elliptic curve cryptography keys rather than using RSA keys. The problem is, in order to keep RSA secure, we've had to start pushing it longer and longer. Back in the early 90s, 512-bit RSA keys were fine. Then it was 1024-bit. Now we're at 2048, and people are starting to look at 3072. Well, these keys, you know, on a reasonable desktop processor are not too bad, but when you put on a mobile processor, you start to get pretty expensive. And so ECC keys are much shorter. So you can have a key that's, you know, I think the number here is a 256 ECC keys equivalent to a 3072-bit RSA key. And so ECC keys, you're starting to see in certificates, and they're going to improve performance. If you're running a server, run the latest version of your software. There are improvements being made all the time, in part because these performance guys, the performance engineers at these companies, are saying, hey, why is our server slow, or why is that server slow when our client connects to it? And they're going out and finding bugs in SSL on those sites, and they're improving the stacks. The key thing is to deploy them. Because even if it's in, you know, the latest version of your framework, if you don't have it on your server, it's not going to help you. Okay. Assuming that we've convinced you to put SSL on your server, what do you do? I love this slide a lot. You know, hey, everybody says encryption is important. But encryption is actually quite difficult. And so there's a lot of subtlety here. I'm not going to, you know, we've already sort of blown through a lot of very advanced topics where I just kind of hand waved and said, you know, use the stronger things. But doing it yourself can be quite hard. And so one of the most exciting things to happen in a very long time for SSL and TLS is that late last year, Mozilla and the EFF announced a project called Let's Encrypt. And Let's Encrypt is a new approach for doing TLS on the web. Basically, they are going to build something where you run it on your server goes out and talks to a certificate authority, gets the certificate, installs that certificate, keeps that certificate up to date, and makes sure that, you know, if there's a revocation, it's handled and so forth. It's free. So you don't have to pay for certificates. You don't have to pay your, you know, your CA based on the number of servers or anything else. It's all transparent and automated. This is going to make a huge difference, and it's hopefully going to drive a lot of sites who feel like, well, I don't really need SSL to say, but it's just so easy. And so the Let's Encrypt project is expected to come out this summer, and I think it's going to make a huge difference in the prevalence of encryption. That doesn't mean, of course, that, you know, it's going to magically do everything for you. Two of the things that you, as a web developer, need to worry about are doing non-secure HTTPS stuff. So a lot of people, you know, back in the day had this optimization of, hey, I'm just going to make my, you know, the page that accepts the password secure. I don't need to make the page that asks for the password secure, which is just completely and horribly wrong, right? Because if there's a bad guy, he's just going to replace the page that asks for the password with his own version that doesn't submit to your secure page. So fortunately, this has become a less common error over time. Some users have started to look for the lock icon, and I've personally yelled it at any site that I've ever seen that does this, including this site that's using Stripe. So Stripe, of course, tries to make the user feel good because they show the little lock icon down here, but the ultimate page up here is HTTP. And so I tweeted about this, and the Stripe guys immediately jumped on it and said, hey, that's in violation of our terms of service. These people are not doing the right thing, blah, 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 blah. And they went and took care of it. But do make sure that you're using HTTPS on ideally every page, but certainly any page where you're asking a user for information. Another problem is including insecure content in your secure pages. This used to be more of a problem prior to about last year when Firefox and Chrome finally got on board and started blocking that mixed content rather than just showing it by default. So in all browsers, it would take away the lock, but most users don't notice that sort of thing. The problem is, in the browser, if you include an insecure style sheet or an insecure JavaScript, it can rewrite the page and completely defeat the point of using SSL at all. All the browsers have come to a common agreement to allow insecure images. They still take away the lock, but because an image can't change the page for the most part, and the prevalence of mixed content images are so common, all the browsers have decided to sort of lose the battle in order to win the war, and so they'll show those insecure images by default. There are still interesting attacks that can take place, so don't do it, but it's not as much of a problem. So SSL only works if people go to the SSL version of your site. So there's a security problem here, which is my address bar, if I type www.face, I get an option to go to http://www.facebook.com. If I do that on a hostile network, I'm never going to end up on https://facebook.com because the bad guy is going to take over immediately, and he's just going to keep it there, and he's going to keep the whole thing in just plain text HTTP. So there's this thing called HTTP strict transport security. HTTP strict transport security is activated by a header, response header, strict transport security, containing a max age for how long you want to keep effectively this record in the browser that says, hey, anytime there's a reference to this server, always contact it over HTTPS. Even if the URL used HTTP, use HTTPS instead. It also makes it so that any certificate errors that are encountered are treated as fatal. So the user can't click through. If somebody man-in-the-middles their connection, they can't click through that error. So HSTS is a great feature. It's going to be supported in all browsers when IE12 comes out. So IE12 is the laggard here. There was also this project called HTTPS Everywhere. It's a plugin for Firefox and Chrome and whatnot that exists even for sites that aren't using this header. They have their own list of sites that use HTTPS, and so it offers that functionality. In Fiddler, there's a custom column you can add that will show all your security headers, like strict transport security and public key pinning and so forth. You can add this column, and one of the advantages, besides seeing what sites are doing a great job on crypto, is that there's a red exclamation mark in any call, in any request or response that has invalid data. And so one of the biggest secure sites in the world that evangelized for the strict transport security header originally, when they first deployed it, had a bug that would prevent it from ever working. And so when they said, hey, check out our stuff, I loaded it up in Fiddler and saw an exclamation point, and I took a closer look, and I sent them the mail and said, yeah, so it turns out you need an equal sign, not a colon there. And so this is a great quick way to make sure that sites are doing the right thing. And you can also make sure that all of your pages and so forth are sending it. Migrating the HTTPS, there's an awesome migration guide underway. I'll publish these slides in the share and you can click through. But basically, migrating to HTTPS is relatively simple. You need to get a certificate, which will get a lot easier in the future. You want to make sure that your intra-site URLs are using protocol relatives. So instead of saying http://foo.js, you just do //site/wacfoo.js, and that will ensure that the protocol that's used for that reference matches the protocol of the top-level page. You want to set the secure attribute on cookies so that all of your cookies are only being sent over secure connections. And then the last thing is you want to run this Qualys SSL server test. This thing is awesome. It will go, you type in your URL, it will go out and analyze literally every possible aspect that's visible to it of your SSL implementation, which ciphers are in use, the strength of your certificate, et cetera, et cetera. It's really, really good. And anytime any hack happens, like, oh, it turns out RC4 is less secure than we thought, essentially within a day or two, it's updated to take account in that information. So if you're worried about some latest hack that you just read about on, you know, Reddit or whatever, you can go see very quickly whether or not you're going to be vulnerable. It's pretty important, I think, to HTTPS all of the things. It's very difficult to predict what's going to end up being a vector for attack in the future. And this is something that people are sort of constantly surprised by because they're like, well, I'm just showing public information. But it turns out that this information very often becomes a source of, attack in some manner. So, like, a great example that I love recently is the time protocol, right? So when your browsers or when your client is syncing its time with some server to ensure that the time is right. Well, that previously was not an authenticated connection. And it turns out there's all sorts of crazy attacks that can be undertaken because of that insecurity. Most recently, the Mac guys had to publish a security advisory and push it to all the Macs because some auxiliary data in there could be malicious, and that auxiliary malicious data could cause remote code execution and so forth. But there's just myriad examples. And so as a result of that, the Google guys are starting to push toward having sort of some sort of like scary banner for things that aren't encrypted. This was my proposal to them. I don't think they're going to do it. But basically to sort of very visually say to users, hey, this thing isn't trusted. And so instead of, you know, just having the lock icon, the subtle little thing when it's secure, instead actively tell the users when they're not secure. And so obviously it's not just about what are we watching, but also what content are we writing today. And so I don't think they're going to do this, but generally speaking, I think that we are going to approach a world where insecure pages start to look bad in some way. Another key point is it's not just about browsers. And in fact, the things that are almost scariest are things that are not about browsers. There's tons of mobile applications that are not using SSL, or they're using SSL with some, you know, ancient SSL stack that doesn't bother to validate that the certificate is actually chained to a trusted root authority. And so the FTC fined some company some huge amount of money recently because it turned out that all of their client server communications, while technically protected by SSL, didn't bother to validate that the certificate was real. And so they were leaking all sorts of like kids' personal information to anybody that wanted to intercept it and so forth. And so mobile stuff is really important. There's other scenarios too. So this is one that came up recently. So when you have your system pull symbols from Microsoft's debug servers, that's over HTTP, which seems fine. They're public symbols. Who cares, right? Well, it turns out within the public symbol stream, there's a thing that allows you to point to a source server, and the source server has the ability to suggest commands for the debugger to run, and those commands can be pretty much anything. Like, I would like you to reconfigure your system in the following way. And so this is not a scenario that anybody ever foresaw as an attack vector, but actually now it kind of is. And so the Google guys actually, I think, almost immediately moved all their servers over to the HTTPS, and bugs are filed against all the other guys. I'm trying to get the Microsoft guys to fix theirs. In the course of researching this talk, I came up with a slide. I found a slide, fortunately, that describes the vast, vast majority of plausible attacks on HTTPS. Almost everything that's attacking HTTPS is not really attacking HTTPS. It's attacking around HTTPS. Because math is hard and there's not that many cryptographers. That's not to say people aren't attacking HTTPS. But HTTPS itself is almost never the weakest link. So here's another comment from some guy on Twitter. You know, we see all of these things in the press about, like, oh, we found this practical way of creating a padding oracle to decrypt SSL3 connections and only, you know, 33,000 connections and things like that. And so, unfortunately, hacks against SSL itself tend to get reported by the press of SSL is broken. And that's very rarely the case. It's usually the case that some particular variant of SSL is, you know, an order of magnitude weaker than we thought, but actually probably still quite good. And so I'm not going to really talk that much about the attacks against the crypto itself. Fortunately, there's a talk later today that's good. How can SSL fail? It turns out there's many, many ways. This is a slide from the guy that wrote the TLS book that I refer to a lot. We're going to look at a quick set of those. Another thing to keep in mind is that HTTPS traffic can be analyzed even without breaking the crypto. I can tell what your source IP is because it's just TCP/IP. I can tell who you're talking to via the destination IP, and I can get even more specific because the server name indicator is sent in clear text, so I can see what site you're talking to. I can see what higher-level protocol you're using, potentially, via the ALPN. And then if your server is configured to accept client certificates before encryption occurs, I can see the information in there. And so some people get client certificates that contain things like their name and their phone number and all this other stuff. Well, if a server is configured to ask for that before negotiating encryption, all that data is sent across the network in clear text. And so just by looking at encrypted traffic, I can get quite a bit of data. Another thing is that SSL doesn't attempt to hide the length of things. And that means that if you can determine the length of certain requests on a page and that reveals information, that can reveal information about where you're going. So I'm a big web perf nut, and I complained on Twitter about 6 months ago that all the Twitter profile images are like junk, because there's the image of like 3K and then there's like 6K of null bytes after it. It's like, these idiots didn't optimize anything. And how did they unoptimize all of these things? They've got this horrible bug. Well, it turns out I had inadvertently discovered a security mitigation that they had come up with, which is, in order to prevent this traffic profiling attack, what they were doing was they were padding these images to a common length. So that instead of, you know, if you're on some news article, right, and there's that Twitter feed at the bottom of all the people commenting on the article, well, conceivably, if that article is over SSL, if I knew the pattern of the profile images on that page, I could infer which article you were visiting based on your traffic to that server. So they padded all of their images to common sizes, so I couldn't know which image you happened to be loading. And so this was awesome, except I noticed one problem in their implementation. Their security team had done this, and then their perf team came along and said, hey, look at these things. They're not optimized, so we're going to gzip them. Well, it turns out Zero's gzip really, really well. And so I tweeted that, and people were like, oh, that's broken. And it turns out they accept their bug reports over this service called HackerOne, and so I published it up there. Twitter bug bounties are all multiples of $140, which I thought was kind of funny. Because I inadvertently dropped an O-Day on them, I had mine donated to charity, but it's kind of an interesting thing to keep in mind. There's also implementation issues. SSL is supposed to, in the current versions of SSL, there's a way to know that whether your connection was truncated so that you didn't get a complete response. There's a protocol, an explicit close notify that the client and server are supposed to exchange so that they know that they securely stopped the transmission. Unfortunately, every SSL stack ignores this. And so if a bad guy is on your connection, he can cause your connection to drop in the middle so that you get incomplete responses, and the browsers won't complain about that. Compression turned out to be a huge problem. Compression wasn't implemented until like 2007 or 2008. TLS itself offers this compression feature. It wasn't implemented until like 2007 or 2008, and within a few short years, they found out how it completely defeats the encryption via creating an Oracle attack. So compression, while still technically part of the protocol, is never ever used. And then the biggest problem is the click-through UI. Basically, the browsers have UI that allow you to click through SSL errors. So you think your CEO's mail is protected by, you know, 2048-bit RSA and 256-bit AES, but it's really not. It's protected by him not clicking on the button that is checked by default in Outlook, right? That's a problem. And so that's why you want to use things like HSTS to help ensure that users can't shoot themselves in the face. Man-in-the-browser attacks or man-in-the-middle attacks. If I'm running my code on your computer, it's not your computer anymore, it's mine. So one of those things is, obviously, SSL can't protect you if the bad guy can just grab the data on your machine directly, or if he can intercept your trust store, add new trusted certificates to it, and then re-sign all the traffic. That's how Fiddler works, a local man-in-the-middle attack. Extended validation, people are like, oh, well, extended validation will stop this because you can't get the green bar. It doesn't work that way. Whether or not a root is EVSSL or not is stored locally on the local machine. I can go twiddle that bit. So briefly, I made EV light up for Fiddler just for fun. What's wrong with this picture? Yes, this is a picture-in-picture attack. The thing in the middle is not a real browser. It is a Fisher's website. Up top is the real website. User may not know the difference. They see the green bar. They're like, oh, look, it's green. It's secure. It's awesome. I'm going to go type my password here. I would not believe this attack would be credible. It turns out this attack is incredibly credible. A certificate authority, whose name shall not be mentioned, had a picture of this attack, except instead of being Windows 8.1 IE11 and Windows 8.1 IE11 screenshots, the outer thing was Windows Vista running IE7, and the inner thing was Windows XP IE6. So Arrow versus Luna, completely different schemes, colors, blah, 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 blah. They had a color screenshot of this. They passed it around the entire information security department, and zero users thought that there was anything amiss. These are information security professionals who were told, hey, there's something weird here. Can you find it? So it turns out these attacks are pretty bad. How about this one? This is Windows Windows 8's Metro browser. Windows 8's Metro browser doesn't have any trusted pixels. The thing on the bottom is a bitmap. If you happen to move your browser, your mouse cursor all the way to the bottom, you would get the real thing that would pop up over the fake thing. But turns out no trusted pixels means that it's very hard to implement something securely. Heartbleed. SSL protocol is very complicated to implement. Turns out that if you have implementation bugs, they're really bad. So there's this attack called Heartbleed, where basically I can steal all the information from your server's memory by saying, hey, I've got a string of 5,000 characters. Those characters are A, B, C, D, E. And you send me back the next 4K of memory. Well, from memory, I might get things like, say, your private key. And then I might decrypt all of that traffic that I collected. And so implementation is very, very hard. OpenSSL tries to implement everything. There's a fork of it called LibreSSL, which is intended to sort of modernize it and have better coding practices. And the Google guys are working on a fork called Boring SSL, whereby they eliminate everything that they're not actually using. So if you're on OpenSSL, you want to patch. And I do mean that literally. OpenSSL is patching today because they found some more vulnerabilities. So you definitely want to keep up to date on your crypto stack. Sometimes you do attack the crypto. I'm not going to talk about that because I'm not smart enough, but at 11:45 in this room, there's a guy talking about what you don't know about crypto can hurt you. He's going to talk about some of the attacks on crypto. I don't think it's HTTPS specific, but basically using the proper block modes and using the proper initialization vectors and things like that. So if you're really into that stuff, that's a great thing. Last thing I want to mention, and basically what got me into this at all, is there's a fantastic book called Bulletproof SSL and TLS. It's written by a guy named Ivan Ristic. He's got a CodeMash discount, 25% off. It's available in both ebook form and paperback form. The discount's valid for this month. It is a 500-page book that covers every conceivable question that you might have. It is freaking awesome, and he keeps it up to date. He's on Twitter as well. And so if you're not interested necessarily in the full book, there's a shorter free chapter thing called the OpenSSL Cookbook. This is useful even if you're just using OpenSSL for things like generating certificates and validating certificates. It has all the command line parameters and what to use it for and so forth. So my request to you is to go forth and secure all the things. And I've run over, so I don't have time for questions, but I will be here and you can come and talk to me then. Thanks.
So, how was
HTTP2 originally? They hoped originally to require SSL for HTTP2, but there was enough pushback from people who didn't want that that it is optional. In practice, you will probably need to use crypto in order to get HTTP2 to reliably work, because firewalls and gateways and so forth may say, oh, there's this connection to port 80, let me go screw with that using my normal rules, and then it'll completely interrupt it. And so I think there's going to be a pretty strong push to get virtually all of the HTTP2 because it's an option. And that's caused a lot of
is it locked in?
It's we're on draft like 17, and draft 17 versus 16 changed like punctuation. So it's very nice. Microsoft deployed the Windows 10 preview. So it's a little bit
alright, thanks. Appreciate it.
Hi, Rod. Yes. Awesome. Well, it's not mine. It's from the book.
Still, but I mean, just you
explain it. Yeah. Nice to meet you. Thanks. Yes.
Because of the
Yes. So basically there's this include subdomains parameter that controls whether or not it is applied to all the subdomains. You really do want it to, because there's a problem in cookies, and the problem with cookies is a cookie that's sent to foo.com is also sent to every subdomain of foo.com. And so what that means is, even if you don't have a subdomain of foo.com, if you don't have include subdomains, an attacker can create a reference to fake.foo.com, cause your browser to load it, and it'll load over the insecure channel. Now, yes. Now, if all of your cookies are marked as secure, that means he would have to get a fake cert for that subdomain, which hopefully would be hard. So if you're not going to use include subdomains, do make sure that you're at least adding a secure attribute on that. Well, yeah, but it turns out that in most cases they're all sensitive because, oh look, there's a script injection in this cookie where, you know, we echo the contents of this cookie to the HTML on some page, and now I've got an XSS attack and things like that. But yes, I mean, if your site is really HTTPS, there's no reason not to mark them all secure, because those cookies don't need to be going anywhere that's not secure.
I'm Jen. I'm your proctor for this session.
They'll be in. There's going to be some, like, if you go to the Google group for this, there's a reference to the official slide share thing, and I'll put them up there.
I switched from .NET to open source on a Mac recently, and the only thing I haven't found a suitable replacement for is Fiddler.
Yeah. So, our
Wireshark is lame.
Our